One of the things I've always liked about the Buddhist teachings, if you look at it as a religion, is the founder is someone who knows what it's like to be imperfect. He himself started out with defilements, with misunderstanding, and yet still was able to find awakening, find an end to suffering. So he knows what it's like to try to attempt to develop the perfections, but you're coming with an imperfect history, and we're living in an imperfect world. And he shows how to find the perfections, develop the perfections in the midst of all that. For example, you're developing goodwill. And you find there are people who have ill will toward you. And you have to remind yourself, you've probably had ill will toward others in the past. So this is nothing out of the ordinary. If you didn't have that karmic background, it wouldn't be happening to you. So one, you can take comfort in the fact that everybody else in the human realm has this experience. And when the Buddha taught the end of suffering, he didn't ask first, do you deserve to suffer? Only if you don't deserve to suffer will I teach you the end of suffering. He teaches the end of suffering whether it's deserved or not, and put the word deserved in quotes. He never talks about anyone deserving to suffer, no matter how bad their past karma may be. Because as we've seen today, he has that image of the lump of salt. We all have our lumps of salt. But we have the ability to develop our minds so that we're like big rivers of clean, clear water. We may start out with little cups of water, but it is possible to develop this quality of goodwill until it becomes measureless. We can also develop our endurance, realizing that unpleasant things will happen. The Buddha himself had people criticizing him. He had a cousin who tried to steal monks away from him, cause a split in the Sangha. They had to put up with all kinds of things, training the monks, training the nuns. He read the suttas, and it was hard enough for him to have to deal with strange people coming with strange questions. But then with the monks and the nuns, the people who were supposedly devoting their lives to the practice would still do outrageous things. And so he had to formulate a rule. And sometimes they would try to wiggle around the rule. There was one case with Dabba Malabhutta. He was an arahant from age 7. And so he is with the rest of his life. What is he going to do? So he asked the Buddha permission to be of service to the Sangha. So the Buddha gives him two roles to fill. One is to be what they call the assigner of lodgings, where new monks come in the evening or in the afternoon. And it was Dabba Malabhutta's duty to assign them a lodging. And word quickly got around among the monks, if you came at night, Dabba Malabhutta could take you by the light of his finger. He had some psychic powers. You could enter the fire element and his finger was like a flashlight. So everybody wanted to see this, so they would come at night on purpose and ask for faraway lodgings. And as for assigning meals, this is one of the more difficult roles in the Sangha. There are certain rules about how you go through the list of monks to assign different meals. And you can never guarantee that everybody's going to get the same kinds of meals or the same kind of treatment when they go to the meals. So sometimes you're following the rosters, but the monks find out that their friends get more than they do, or monks they don't like get more than they do, and they can be difficult. There was one case where this one donor gave meals to 4 monks every day. And one day he happened to be visiting with Dabba Malabhutta and asked him, oh, by the way, who's coming to my meal tomorrow? And Dabba Malabhutta gave him a list of monks. Now, these monks were known to misbehave. And the donor was thinking to himself, gee, how can I have these people in my house? So he went back home. He told the slave woman, "Hey, tomorrow when the monks come, don't bring them into the house. Take them out to a shed outside and give them the worst rice and just pickle brine." So the monks that night heard that tomorrow's meal was going to be at this house, and so they were, couldn't sleep that much because they were thinking about what a great meal they would have the next day. But then the next day they get there and they take him to the shed and given the worst rice and some pickle brine. And the monks say to the slave woman, "Hey, we're the monks who invited for this special meal." She says, "I know, but the master said yesterday after visiting Dhammamalabhuta to feed you here." So they conceive a grudge against Dhammamalabhuta. And so they talk this one nun into claiming to the Buddha that Dhammamalabhuta had raped her. And so the Buddha calls Dhammamalabhuta in and asks about this. And he says, "Ever since I was born, I've never even had a thought of lust, much less engaged in anything like this." And so the Buddha orders that the nun be disrobed. And then with her disrobing, then they find out who's been spreading the rumor. And so the Buddha has to formulate a rule. You do not make false accusations of offenses that would entail leaving the monkhood, which is what rape would. So you think that would be the end of the story. Well, no, the monks still hold their grudge. So one day they see a billy goat and a nanny goat copulating. They say, "Okay, we'll do it like this. We'll name the billy goat Dhammamalabhuta and we'll name the nanny goat Metiya Bhikkhuni. And then we'll go out and tell everybody, before we suspected it, but now we've seen it with our own eyes, Dhammamalabhuta copulating with this Metiya was her name." And so the Buddha has to go through the whole procedure all over again. And say, not only do you making false accusations, but drumming up evidence that really isn't evidence is also an offense. So the Buddha had to deal with all kinds of stuff. And yet he didn't suffer. He was criticized. There are people who falsely accused him of all kinds of things. So when you think about that, you remind yourself, okay, when I'm falsely accused, when I'm criticized, this is nothing abnormal. Even the best people in the world have to face this. So that thought can help you develop some equanimity and some endurance. And you learn how to take these things in stride. This is just a normal part of the world. A normal part of having an imperfect history and living in an imperfect world. But this is still our opportunity to develop the perfections. So keep that in mind. When difficult things come, it's an opportunity to develop perfections of the character. And try to think to yourself in ways that don't get you down. And one of the important things is that thought that I mentioned just now, realizing, okay, we all have bad karma. And your bad karma from the past may be showing right now, but that doesn't mean that's all you have. At the same time, other people who are not getting that kind of rough treatment doesn't mean that they don't have that in their past too. So that when you're going through a period when everybody's just praising you, don't let it go to your head. You say, "Well, maybe there is some bad karma still back there and I still have to be prepared. This is why we have to be heedful." But if we can learn how to approach these things with a certain amount of equanimity and a certain amount of broad-mindedness, then it's a lot easier to deal with the difficult people in the world. So, okay, even though they're wishing ill will in my direction, I have the power to rise above that. They may be saying things intentionally to hurt my feelings. I don't have to let that get to me. Because this is what that principle of the mind as an active principle really means. Is you have the choice whether you're going to allow yourself to suffer from something or not. That's not just a simple choice that requires developing some skills, but you have the choice whether you want to try to develop those skills or not. And the choice of whether or not you want to stick with the path. So as I said earlier, even though the perfections don't include the quality of conviction, which is in some of the other lists of dharmas that are useful for developing the skills you need and creating the good karma you're going to need for happiness, not only in this lifetime, but also in the future lifetime. Having conviction that the Buddha taught a good path. And this is a good path to be on. And even though it's just a belief, it doesn't get in the way of experience. It points out why it is important to experience these things. Because there are some teachings that say you can't trust your experience at all. But the Buddha is saying that your experience of what you're doing right now is where the source of happiness lies. So you want to get very sensitive to that. And develop the right bodily fabrication, i.e. the breath. So you have a sense of well-being. The right verbal fabrication that deals with the breath in this way, but also allows you to think in other ways when other things come in to invade the mind. You can learn how to ask yourself the right questions. So you can come to the right answers that will alleviate stress, alleviate suffering, and then hold the right perceptions in mind that also help you in that direction. And John Fuang talks about when he was a young monk. He just ordained. And he was living in a monastery where the vinaya was not really well practiced. They didn't do any meditating. He was beginning to get discouraged. He'd been orphaned as a young kid, age 11. Didn't do well in school. He kept thinking to himself, my only way out of this misery is to follow the path. And I'm in a situation where I can't follow it well. Fortunately, the second year, he found Ajahn Lee and was inspired by him. And so whenever he met up with difficulties in the path, he kept reminding himself, if I don't follow this path, it's nothing but poverty and misery for me. Now, we may not be facing that kind of poverty, but we all have our sufferings, things that really pain the heart, pain the mind. And the path is offering a way out. And the Buddha is saying that even though you may have an imperfect past, and you may be seeing the results of that imperfect past, either in situations coming from outside or thoughts coming up in your own mind, habits you've bad habits you've developed, you never deserve to suffer. You don't have to be a victim. You can say, even though it's difficult out there, I can still have a source of strength inside. So make use of whatever sources you can find in it. They're there. Do what you can to develop your conviction, your heedfulness, your sense of endurance. One of John Fung's good comments was, if he asked me to do something difficult and I started to complain that it was difficult, he said, look, is this going to kill you? No. Then you can do it. And I found it many times, the biggest obstacle in my path was me. My unwillingness to put myself out a little bit. And all the pictures the mind painted about all the difficulties were going to face me, that I was going to face, excuse me. So look around your own mind and see what are the obstacles inside. This is why they call them defilements. Not because they're evil, it's just because they obscure your path. Obscure your ability to follow the path. And remember to practice the perfections in concert. We're taking them one by one as we go through the discussion. But they do work together. And there's a skill in getting them to work together. For example, with goodwill, you want to make it totally unlimited. But with your generosity, you realize you have limited strength, limited abilities, limited time. So even though there are many opportunities to be generous, you can't take all of them. And as the Buddha said, if you find yourself being generous to the point where it's actually harming you, you back off. Which is why goodwill has to be paired with equanimity. Saying that within my limitations, I want to figure out the best thing to do, the best use of my time. So I don't fritter away banging my head against the wall over things that I can't change. Or over things that I could change, but it would detract from things that are more important. This is why discernment has to be the guiding principle all the time. To remind you, what are your ultimate goals? What is your top priority? What is the most prior of these perfections? Parang of the Barnabas. That is the development of discernment, the discernment that frees you. And so you exercise your discernment as you develop the other perfections. And like them, it's going to start out imperfect. Discernment doesn't require that you be especially well educated, or that you know a lot about the suttas. It simply requires that you learn how to ask the right questions. What's going on? What am I doing that's causing suffering? What is the principle of cause and effect that's acting right now? And where do you see that? By watching your own mind. And just learning how to see when suffering comes up, what comes along with it? When it goes away, what went away along with it? Can I see why I go for it when it comes? They're simple questions. They require, though, that you be very, very observant. Because the mind has a tendency to cover things up with lots of layers of denial. It creates lots of other issues that pull you away from this big issue. We all want happiness, and yet we do things that cause unhappiness. Why do we do them? Why do we go to the effort of making ourselves unhappy? It's because we're ignorant. We don't understand what suffering is. We don't understand the cause. We don't understand how to develop the path to the end. But this ignorance can be overcome. John Suwat's image is of a lamp. You take a lamp into a place that's been dark for aeons. And even though the darkness has been there for a long, long time, it can't claim the right to continue. Once the lamp comes in, the light chases it away. So no matter how long you've been ignorant, these insights into what are you doing right now? Where is the suffering? What are you doing that's causing the suffering? What can you do to abandon the cause? These are the questions that bring light. This is what takes your imperfect discernment and makes it perfect enough to put an end to the cause of suffering. And that's all you really need. There are so many things in the world out there that we may not understand. But if you can understand this much, you fulfilled the Buddha's reasons for teaching. No matter how much unskillful behavior you've engaged in the past, the fact that you become heedful and learn how to stop and develop more skill in this place, as the Buddha said, illumines the world. It's what makes the human world a brighter place. When an individual decides, I'm going to rise above my old ways, rise above my situation. This, the Buddha says, illumines the world in the same way the moon at night. When there's a full moon, it's been obscured by clouds, and all of a sudden the clouds blow away. And everything becomes bright. It's the people who do this that make the world a bright place. The media don't have to know. Nobody has to know. But the fact that you've done that, the fact that you know that yourself, that knowledge is enough in and of itself right there.